just learning God and learning new things, learning just about the book of Genesis. And Lord, I pray you just allow John to really give us something that we could definitely use, God, for our own lives and to help others. But thank you so much for the San Diego Church and for John just to organize this and put this on. And pray that it could encourage our hearts and give us a better understanding of the word. Thank you for this day, for all the
pain. Amen. All right, great. So we got as far as Genesis chapter 3 2 weeks ago. Whoops. Well, hopefully we can pick up the pace a little bit here. Let's remind ourselves of the great themes in Genesis. God, the creator, God, a loving creator. The fall, sin, temptation, not in that order. Temptation, sin, separation from God, judgment, and then salvation. Okay? In Genesis, we meet God. And really, Genesis serves as an introduction to the entire scripture. All right, and then we talked about our outline. We already finished part one, the original state of the world, which was in perfection. And the definition of perfection is us in relationship with God and with a relationship with each other. Genesis chapter 3 through 11, the section that we may complete today if we're lucky, which is kind of the bad news, and it's about how we lost the place that we have with God. It's a story of separation from God. Then chapter 12 through 50, God is initiating the plan, which will be fulfilled in the New Testament, to bring salvation to his people. All right, so we got through chapter 2. We got a bunch of slides here. Oh my goodness, all kinds of stuff. All these creation myths. Chapter 3, the fall. And we were finishing up thinking about the fall. And it seems to be a pretty significant question, which is, what happened to us? How were Adam and Eve different? And how, therefore, were we different because of the sin of Eve and of Adam? And so what are some thoughts about that? The Bible doesn't make it 100% clear, I would say. Yeah?
I don't think they're that much different because we're all tempted.
Okay.
To sin.
So you would argue that they did have a sinful nature even before they fell.
I don't think I argued that. I just said they're not that different.
Well,
they did enjoy a time, though, when there was no sin.
Yeah,
okay. They did enjoy a time, as you said, of perfection.
Uh-huh. Right, but my question is, clearly they were different. For example, before they were not ashamed, and now they are ashamed, and they have more knowledge than they had, knowledge that God didn't want them to have. All right, but that's what I already said. I'm just going to ask out there, how would you characterize how they were different? And again, I don't think the answer is totally obvious. Kathy. Okay. Yeah, good.
Has there been any research about their age or what kind of chemicals are in the brain? I don't know. Is that important?
Their age?
When they, yeah. Is there
how would you do research? I don't know how you would do research into their age. What do you mean?
Were they teenagers?
We don't know. First of all, they were, if you take literally, and I do, if you take literally that they were created, then they were basically adults as created mature. So I don't know if you could be a teenager. They have to be the equivalent of 35 to be a teenager. I don't know. Anyway, I don't have an answer for that question. But my question is, how were they different or how were they changed? Yes.
I think that with knowledge, they began to question more.
Okay. Right. So they started to even judge God in some way because they realized what God they realized maybe more potential. Okay, we see in the Tower of Babel something along those lines. Okay, now Calvinists tell us that in Adam's fall we sinned all. And so the Catholic Church, but even more so Protestants, have traditionally taught original sin, and that we genetically inherit sin from Adam and some kind and a sinful nature as well. I'm not sure exactly how to think about that. Certainly, we were more prone to sin because of the knowledge that we inherited. I don't know. It's just something for you to think about. I don't have a definite answer there. So now we're... Well, right. Of course, they lost that intimate connection with God, clearly, as they were kicked out of the garden. That's for sure. Those are those direct consequences. The direct consequences of their sin were, as we saw, I think we've got the slide here, pain and suffering, and probably more pain and more suffering rather than any at all. Harder labor, all right, and physical death, it seems like. Perhaps their bodies may have been immortal, and spiritual death, separation from God. Okay, got it?
Wait, can you go back two slides? What was 1 Corinthians 15? I just want to jump.
Okay, yes.
Thanks.
Actually, we're gonna. Let me talk about that now, actually, because that's talk a little bit about Adam, because. The Bible talks about Adam as a prefigure in both Romans chapter 5 and 1 Corinthians chapter 15. So thank you for stopping me. Let's look at that a little bit. Romans 5, 12 through 19 is the whole section. Let's read 12 through 15. And so the Bible makes a parallel between Adam and Jesus in Romans 5, 12 through 15. And this is one of the harder passages, really, in the entire New Testament to understand. It's one of those Paul kinds of things. It says, therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned. To be sure, sin was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not charged against anyone's account when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who's a pattern of the one to come. So who's Adam a pattern of?
Jesus.
He's a pattern of Jesus, which can be a little bit confusing, I guess. So he says, but the gift is not like the trespass. For if the many died by the trespass of one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the many? So just as in Adam all died, in Jesus all have at least the opportunity for life. And then there's 1 Corinthians 15, 45 through 49, which in my opinion is even a little bit harder to exactly get. He's talking about basically Jesus being the second Adam. 1 Corinthians 15, 45 through 49. So Adam is a prefigure of Jesus in a way that's a little bit hard to totally get, I think. All right, 15, 45 through 49. Says here, okay. So it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam, a life-giving spirit. The spiritual did not come first, but the natural, and after that, the spiritual. All right, the first man was of the dust of the earth. The second man is of heaven. As was the earthly man, so are those who are of the earth. And as is the heavenly man, so also are those who are of heaven. And just as we have borne the image of the earthly man, so we shall bear the image of the heavenly man. So basically saying, I think he's saying we receive our physical nature from Adam and our spiritual nature from Jesus. All right. So whatever we lost in this fall, certainly innocence is one of them, that's for sure. a greater propensity to sin? Probably. Actual sin of Adam? Definitely not. All right, let's go on to Cain and Abel. So basically, the way it works in Genesis is it goes from bad to worse. All right, and Cain is more hardened in his sin than Adam and Eve were. All right, so let's read, starting in verse 3, Genesis 4. Okay, now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, and Abel also brought an offering, fat portions, from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor, so Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Now, the Bible doesn't say why God looked with greater favor on Abel's sacrifice than Cain's. All right, so let me leave that screen because I want us to speculate why, and I've got my proposed answers up. So what are some reasons, possibly, that God didn't look on Cain's sacrifice with favor? Yeah. Okay, what's your evidence that he didn't have the right attitude? I agree with that, by the way. What's your evidence?
Well, instead of changing his attitude and becoming more like his brother, he got angry.
Yeah, you can tell. When he's confronted about it, his total self-centered approach is pretty clear. And if he's that self-centered, then certainly his sacrifice must have been self-centered as well. Good, yes. Right.
He brings an offering of the fat portions of the
firstborn. Right.
He fed God his best.
Yes. So Abel gave the best, and the implication, although not directly stated, the implication is Cain did not. Other comments? Yeah, Rudy,
it was
and then.
Defensive.
Later on, you see from his defensiveness.
He acted like something was wrong already.
Right.
So he was guilty.
Right, right. So that's what was already said. That essentially, although it doesn't say he didn't give his best, the clear implication he didn't give his best. Some people have proposed because he brought grain instead of meat. And maybe, there's no indication here. And, possibly. I think the idea that he didn't give his best is clear. Another suggestion is maybe he didn't follow the instructions. We don't know that. Maybe God said do this, this, and this, and he literally just didn't even do the things he was told. We don't really know that. But what we do know is that his sacrifice was not given in faith. Hebrews 11:4, where the Hebrew writer makes a clear distinction with regard to Abel, and by implication, as opposed to Cain. Hebrews 11:4, it says, by faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. And why was it better? I believe because he brought it in faith. All right, at least certainly one of the reasons. By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offering. And by faith, Abel still speaks even though he's dead. I really love that. Because of his faith, Abel still speaks. I don't know about you, but when I die, I hope what they'll say about me, that brother was faithful. You know, and there's a distinction between faith and faithful. And I think that's what the book of Malachi is about. The book of Malachi, the Jews had faith in God, but they weren't faithful to God. Their view of God was somebody to do them favors. And I think Cain figured, hey, I gave God such and such, so he should give me such and such. All right, I think I'm preaching a little bit here, but anyway, that's okay. I have permission to do a little preaching.
Yeah.
Yeah, Cain felt like he'd purchased God's favor, but it doesn't work that way. There's this Hebrew word, chesed. And maybe you've heard Robert Creo do his lesson about chesed, which is basically, it's translated love, but it can also be translated faithful or loyal. And that's the problem in Malachi, where the people said, God says, you're bringing me junk gifts. And they're saying, what are you talking about? They don't get it. All right? And another way we can tell that he didn't give it the right attitude is, like you all said, is the guy got really angry. Really angry. And God says, hey, if you did the right thing, what are you angry about? If all you had to do was the right thing. Now, one possible reason that Cain was so angry is that he was the older brother. And Abel was the younger brother. And of course, we're reading sort of Babylonian culture on this, sort of Mesopotamian culture, which didn't necessarily apply for the first people to ever live. But we're looking through a Mesopotamian lens here. And the older brother is supposed to be the favored one, not the younger brother. So there's clearly jealousy going on there as well. And this is an often repeated theme throughout the book of Genesis, and really in the Old Testament, where God offers his grace to the younger son. And who's the younger son, symbolically? Us! Right. The Jews are the older son, and we're the younger son. The Jews are Ishmael, and we're Isaac. The Jews are Esau, and we're Jacob. The Jews are Cain, and we're Abel. That's the symbolism. And like it says in Malachi 1, verse 2, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. And that's what Paul comes back to in Romans chapter 9, where the Jews are ticked off at God for allowing Gentiles to be saved. And God says, look, Jacob I loved. And if you don't stop being Jacob, being like Esau, you're going to be Esau instead of Jacob, because you need to be faithful. So I think the lesson here is that Abel was faithful to God, and Cain clearly was not. All right, let's read on a little bit here. Then the Lord said to Cain, why are you so angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. One of the clearest indications of free will is right here, where we're told it's our job to master the temptation and not to give in to it and not to sin. The pattern in Genesis 3 that we already saw is repeated in Genesis 4, as we're seeing now, is repeated in Genesis 6, as we see the sons of God doing whatever they want to the daughters of man. And then it's repeated again in the pattern with Babel, which is temptation, sin, making excuses, consequences. And then God provides hope. God provides healing. And God does that even with Cain. Cain deserved to be taken out. I mean, he was a murderer. His flesh, the blood of his brother cried out from the ground. And what's Cain doing? Complaining that the judgment on him was too harsh. Hello? How about capital punishment? All right? So that's the pattern. And then God does to Cain what he did to Adam and Eve, is he asks them a question that he knows the answer to. God says, you know, why are you wearing clothes, as if God doesn't know? So God says here in verse 9 and 10, Cain said to his brother, we know that part, right? So he's tempted, and God warns him, he gives in, he kills his brother, right? So now we're in verse 9. Then the Lord said to Cain, where's your brother? I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Well, that's interesting. Is he his brother's keeper? Is he his brother's keeper? I don't think he is. I think we slightly misuse this passage. Not a big deal. You don't need to feel guilty. But I think we slightly misuse this passage. Because he was not his brother's keeper. To be his keeper means he's in charge of his brother. And he's saying, don't blame me. You know, who made me my brother's keeper? I think what he was supposed to be is his brother's helper, his brother's close friend, his discipler even, all right, but not his keeper. In other words, I think Cain is exaggerating. He's accusing God of making him responsible, all right, and he's not. Do you have a point, Paul? You're cleaning your glasses. You're pointedly cleaning your glasses. I need to do that often as well. Great. So I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm reading something in here that's not here. But I think Cain is sort of like complaining because he's the older brother, you know. So therefore, I'm responsible. And I do think, you know, we are responsible for each other in some ways. But maybe we're mainly responsible for ourselves. I don't know. But anyway. Are we our brother's keeper? You go ahead and keep saying we are. I think it's okay to say that. But maybe this passage was not intended to teach necessarily that we're our brother's keeper. I think it's more like what he should have done, which is he should have watched out for his brother. And he should have imitated his brother's faith. But anyway, I don't know. Maybe I should not even have said that, but I just said it anyway. Okay, great. So, has Cain repented? Let's see. All right. The Lord said, what have you done? And again, one thing God does is rather than accuse, he asks questions, just like he did with Adam and Eve. Rather than accuse, he asked questions. And I think that's really good sort of practical advice is if somebody is pretty clearly messed up, rather than saying you messed up, start asking questions. Hey, what happened? You know, how did you feel about that? How did that work? All right, that's what God is doing. God is trying to help Cain come to a realization on his own rather than just blitzing him. Yes?
I was just wondering if we could also learn something about parenting from, did Adam and Eve, the parents?
You mean about how good a job they did?
Yeah.
We know absolutely nothing about their parenting. All right, so you'd have to speculate. I mean, do we know anything about how good a job of parenting they did? We do know that Cain messed up real badly. I would say this, they did a bad job in that they sinned themselves. They set a bad example. But, you know, the day-to-day parenting they did of their kids, you know, I don't know whether we don't know much about it. We definitely know they set a bad example, though. All right, and we know that two of their sons did quite well, actually, and one of their sons really blew it big time. So, yeah, something interesting to think about. All right, so God makes provision for Cain. All right, again, we see James 1:14-15 breaking it, you know, kind of coming into effect. Our evil desire produces temptation. We give in sin. And then because of sin, we receive consequences, we receive separation, we receive death, separation from God. And so Genesis 3 and Genesis 4 could both serve as kind of like a paradigm for the nature of sin and for the consequences of sin. All right, so probably I see evidence in Genesis 3, 14 through 13, 13 to 14 of Cain having what, worldly sorrow, right? Yeah, he's more sorry that he got caught. And evidence of that is that he is ticked off about the consequences. He's not happy that God has brought some consequences in for his sin. All right, so reading on here. Let me see. Verse 13. Cain says, Lord, my punishment is more than I can bear. Today you're driving me from the land, and I will not be hidden from your presence. I'll be hidden from your presence. I'll be hidden. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth. Whoever finds me will kill me. And what we see here is sin separates us from God and makes us lonely. So sin impacts our relationship with God, and it impacts our relationship with one another. And it says that he went to the land of Nod. But Nod means wandering. So whether there was a place called Nod or not, he basically became a wanderer. And so many in this world are wandering spiritually. They don't have a spiritual home. So many people are like Cain. They've sinned. They've lost their relationship with God. In many ways, they've lost the relationships with one another they should have. And they're wandering around in the land of Nod, which means wandering. All right, any questions about Cain and Abel as we go on? Yes.
Yeah, where did the other people come from?
Oh, I'm getting to that. Because Cain is going to have children, as is Seth. I'll get to that. Yes. Because that's the story of Genesis. The story is sin, separation, judgment, but also the opportunity for salvation. So he's giving him hope. Right, he puts the mark. I mean, we don't know what the mark was, but basically the mark said, don't you dare touch Cain. If you touch Cain, God says, I'm going to take you out. So that grace. Every single time that God foreshadows judgment, he also foreshadows salvation every time. And so the message is that that there's hope. God's trying to provide hope.
Later, he would make a law that would say an eye for an eye type of thing.
Right, right.
In this case, he makes an exception.
He did. God made an exception. And spiritually, of course, even murderers can be saved. So the legal, for example, there was capital punishment in Israel, as you know. Yeah. Okay. So now we're in Genesis 4, starting in verse 17, and here's one of these genealogies that can be, you know, a bit boring to us, I guess. All right. So starting in verse 17, it says here, I'm not going to read this whole genealogy. Cain made love to his wife and she became pregnant. So who did he marry? Well, did Adam and Eve have daughters? Yes, we know they did. How do they know it? Because it says so. In Genesis 5, verse 4, it said Adam had other sons and daughters.
Right.
How many sons and daughters did he have? I don't know. Probably at least 20. I'm pretty sure they kept having sex, and I'm pretty sure kids kept getting born. You know, I think so. I don't think they had any birth control. So I'm guessing they had a lot of children. How much time, what kind of parents were they? How much time is it? There's so many things we don't know. I mean, how many years later did Cain marry? Was it 50 years? Was it 100 years? Was it 200 years? Were Adam and Eve great, 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 great grandparents by then? We don't know. What we do know is there were quite a few people by this time, right? Because Cain was worried about these people in these other places persecuting him. Yeah, Michael.
It does seem like where they do mention their ages when they have kids is pretty old.
Right.
At least to our standards.
Right. The ages at which they began to have children was greater, and the ages that they lived were also greater. Correct. Now, I'm not going to go into all this genealogy stuff, all right? But the bottom line is, what you see is Cain's descendants pursuing worldly things. Now, a lot of these, in quotes, worldly things aren't bad things, but they're things of the world. And Seth's descendants, and Seth is the one through whom Christ comes, the one through whom Noah comes, Abraham, etc. Seth's descendants are more spiritual, And Cain's descendants are more worldly. And again, we see the lesson. And that parenting thing, maybe there's something about parenting going on there. For example, Cain's descendants are building cities. Nothing wrong with building cities. They're raising cattle. They're starting industries. They're creating music. Again, nothing bad about that. It's just that the only thing worth mentioning about these people were their worldly accomplishments. There's no mention of anything spiritual going on. And we can see the results of that. There's Lamech. That guy Lamech, he's quite a dude. Genesis 4, 23 and 24. Lamech, who's the great-great-grandson, great-great-great-grandson of Cain, something like that. Lamech said to his wives, uh-oh, there's a problem right there. All right, he's got more than one wife, the first evidence of polygamy. Ada and Zilpah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. Jesus said to forgive 77 times. And Lamech says, I'm going to take revenge 77 times. And what you see is a gradual progression. Sin is destroying the spiritual fiber of the society and the culture. But Seth's children, starting in verse 25, are more spiritually minded. For example, his son Enosh, look what it says here, verse 26. Seth had a son, and he named him Enosh. And at that time, people began to call on the name of the Lord. Well, all right, probably Seth called on the name of the Lord, but apparently there were certain people who were seeking God and trying to be spiritual. Enosh is one of them. And then if you go through all these other guys, Adam and then Enosh and then Kenan and all these other people, then you get to Enoch. That's kind of interesting. Let's read about Enoch in Genesis chapter 5, 21 through 24. See how we just made it, skipped a lot of stuff. Awesome. Because there's a lot of stuff that we're not going to get caught up on. All right, so when Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. You've heard of Methuselah because that's the longest living male in the Bible. Enoch walked faithfully with God for 300 years. He had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived a total of 365 years. He walked faithfully with God, and he was no more before because God took him away. And again, there are two people in the Old Testament that appear to be the similar pattern, and that's Enoch and Elijah. So why do you think God took Enoch away, and why do you think he took Elijah away? Because their names started with an E? Yeah, because basically they were what God hoped Adam and Eve would be. All right? Men and women who would walk with God. We don't know much about Enoch, but we can read about him in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 5. Hebrews 11, verse 5. It says, by faith, Enoch was taken from this life, so they did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken away. He's quoting from Genesis there. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists, and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. My opinion is that what happened to Enoch and Elijah is what God intended to happen to Adam and Eve. Is that they should live in these bodies for a certain amount of time and then taken, presumably to live in a new kind of body, the body that's described in 1 Corinthians 16, that different kind of body that we'll eventually have. So I believe God's intention was for us to pass from this life into that existence without having to go through physical death. And for two people, they're sort of teasing us. They're sort of like, wow, they're kind of getting us to imagine what it's going to be like. All right, so that's Enoch. And then, of course, Elijah in 2 Kings chapter 2. All right, so we don't know a lot about Enoch, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on Enoch, but it's sort of awesome. All right, so, great, I forgot to forward my PowerPoint. Yes?
Was he?
That's a good question, because he did die. See, he was taken twice. Jesus was taken twice. And so, if anything, the first being taken is more like it than the second one. In other words, he was taken away. He was resurrected, right? And he said, don't touch me because I haven't gone to the Father yet, right? And then he goes away, and then he comes back, and now they can touch him. So we could speculate the transformation that happened to Jesus' body is the transformation that happened to Enoch and Elijah. We can speculate that. I think that's a fairly reasonable speculation. All right? We don't really know, but it's kind of interesting. And then, of course, Jesus was raised. He was ascended, and that's a different kind of taken away. But I think it's a reasonable speculation that the transformation that happened to his body is what happened to Enoch and Elijah. Speculation, but a reasonable one. All right, so anyway, so we're talking about these genealogies. We're going to get into the flood. But to summarize Genesis 5 in just very, very few words, the genealogy of Cain is the story of people who are worldly-minded, focused on things of the world, and they're going from bad to worse. But there's the genealogy of Seth, and again, there's this parallel thing, even with Cain, even God gave hope. So Seth is the one through whom Noah and Abraham and Moses come. So God's plan to save us is found in Seth and his descendants. God's judgment on those who do not seek him is found on Cain and his descendants. That's kind of the general thing going on in that genealogy. The genealogies are not complete. We have in Matthew 1, the genealogy in Matthew skips generations. So whether or not this gives us an exact timeline for all these guys, I really don't know. Now, in Genesis 5, 28 through 32, we're transitioning to the next story. So it basically says, God leaves this thing with hope. Verse 30, after Noah was born, Lamech lived 595 years. He had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Lamech lived a total of 777 years. Then he died. And Noah was 500 years old when he became father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So he's introducing Noah, in whose time judgment will come and through whom salvation will come. But he's going to do this really strange little side trip to talk about. Basically, we're about to tell the story, but then we're going to do a little explanation of what's going on behind the scenes. And it's pretty gross. It's pretty disgusting. It's pretty horrifying. What's going on behind the scenes? So Genesis 6 through 9, the flood. We're going to see the same pattern. Mankind becomes corrupt. God punishes. God gives hope and provides for restoration. All right, so let's read Genesis 6, 1 through 8, this kind of weird passage. All right. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters are born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them, they were heroes of old, men of renown. All right, let's stop right there. So who are these sons of God and these daughters of man? My opinion is the sons of God are guys, and the daughters of man are girls. But more specifically, these sons of God, these were the powerful people, right? They were the men of renown, the heroes of old. So, again, there's different theories. I'm going to present both of these theories. So one idea is these were the rulers, the powerful aristocratic people, And they were taking whoever they wanted. If they saw a beautiful woman, they took her. All right? And the word to marry is the word take. Now, take is a euphemism for marry, I guess, in the Hebrew language. But there's another word for marry, which it would be our normal word for marry. So it says they took these women. Were they taking them violently? Maybe. Were they raping them? Possibly. Maybe not. We don't know. It's possible not. Because in order to have a marriage back then, maybe you had to kind of get the family involved. We don't really know. So one possibility is these were these sons of Cain, these worldly men who were seeking power and greatness for themselves. And they were doing whatever they wanted, including disrespecting the sort of the bounds of culture and society and taking whoever they want, just allowing their passion to just dictate what they do. That's a possibility. Another possibility is they were somehow angelic beings or something like that. The book of Enoch, chapter 6, verse 2, suggests that. In 2 Peter 2, 4 through 5, it kind of, sort of, almost seems in a way, because it does talk about angels, but it's not talking about angels producing children. There's also the book of Jubilees. This is another Jewish writing. So the Jewish idea of this was that these were angelic beings having unnatural relationships with women. I don't know. I don't really buy that, to be honest with you, but I don't know. I've got my prejudices. Feel free to think what you want. But these Nephilim, to me, are just these really powerful guys, you know, kind of doing whatever they want. And that would explain why you have Nephilim before and after the flood, since presumably they were wiped out, right? So how are they showing up again? Well, they're showing up again because these arrogant, worldly, prideful, power-crazed men are doing whatever they want and taking whoever they want. And those are the Nephilim. And those are the people when Joshua and those guys went into the Promised Land, like, man, these guys, these heroes, they're around. They're afraid of them. Yes, questioner.
Were there any military indication, military or army form at the time, or they were just physically stronger?
You know, if you put this into the context of the Akkadian Empire, once we get to Abraham, definitely there were empires. Once we get to to Babel, and so we're the city, this is the city of Babylon. You can't put dates. Through Genesis chapter 11, this is primeval history. It's proto-history, if you will. And so we can't give definite dates. We can give very, very likely, if not definite, locations. So the information you have is the information you have. Now, one of these descendants of Cain was the first one to make metal implements, and that would include bronze. We know that there were sort of empire-like things as early as 3000 BC in Mesopotamia. All right, and so, but probably 3000 BC is after the flood. So, yeah. People think all kinds of stuff. I mean, the Jews aren't the only ones who thought this. In fact, to be honest with you, if you read that verse, that's almost a natural thing to think. The sons of God married the daughters of man. All right? I'm just telling you, the Jews interpreted it that way. Josephus interpreted that way. Philo, the Jewish philosopher, interpreted that way. And some, but not all, of the early church fathers interpreted that way. And to be honest with you, it's a reasonable interpretation. I'm just saying my opinion is that's not what it is. You know what? It doesn't really actually matter, right? We can agree it doesn't really actually matter. But, yes?
Angels are asexual, though.
Well, you believe that angels are not sexual.
They cannot really.
No, the Bible doesn't say that.
Asexual,
the Bible doesn't say that. The Bible just doesn't answer the question. All right, so you believe that, and I believe that as well.
Okay.
All right, But you can't prove it, and it doesn't matter. Okay? Yes?
So why are they considering sons of God being arrogant, ungodly men?
Well, I mean, you can see they were seeking fame. In fact, when we get to this, we're going to go through the flood. So the Tower of Babel is after the flood. But what's going on in Babel is really seems to be what's going on with these people. They're trying to make a name for themselves. In fact, literally, that's what it says. In Genesis 11, verse 4, it says, they were trying to make a name for themselves. Ouch! All right? And the question I'm going to ask, one of those rhetorical questions is, are you trying to make a name for yourself? These people are trying to make a name for themselves. They were arrogant. They thought that they deserved to treat people however they wanted. They were in power. And people in power tend to do this. They say absolute power corrupts absolutely. Yeah. So that's my take on this situation. But again, I could be completely wrong. It could be that they're actual angelic beings in physical bodies producing children. Yes?
I never thought they were angels because God says in verse 3, my spirit will not contend with humans forever.
Yes, that's true. Right. Okay. Good. All right. That's another reason to think that. Yes. Anyway, by the way, when it says, I will not contend with humans, probably a better translation is, I will not remain. So basically, God's putting his spirit in us. He's saying, and then he says, I'm not going to remain. In other words, it's not like I'm not going to fight with them. I'm not going to remain in them. So he's basically threatening to end the whole deal there. All right? And we can see here that God had reached the point where he... This is an anthropomorphism when he says he regretted, as if God didn't know ahead of time what's going to happen. So let's read this next section here. For the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth. And every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. That sounds a lot like Romans 3, 10 through 18, right? All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. It says they invent ways of doing evil. So to some extent, the state of these people before God came and judged them, it was our state before we were saved. All right? But every inclination of their hearts was evil all the time. The Lord regretted he had made them on the earth. His heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I've created. And with them the animals, the birds, the creatures that move along the ground. For I regret I've made them. Now here's one of the happiest verses in the whole Bible. Aren't you thankful? Aren't you thankful for Noah? It's like the angel that's sitting above Jerusalem about to wipe out the city, and David offers a sacrifice, and the angel pulls back the sword. All right? I mean, it was about to be wiped out. It's what didn't happen in Sodom, right? There was nobody like Noah in Sodom. All right? So I love this verse. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. See, God saw a man of faith. You know, I want us to appreciate the pain that God felt here. I want us to try to feel God's emotion here. This is how God feels about us when we sin. God was deeply pained. It hurt him. It was a kind of pain that it's like Jesus, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? God is feeling a deep pain. His heart was filled with pain. Why? Because the people he loved weren't loving him. And God is a just God. He's a holy God and a loving God. But in this case, his justice and his holiness won out over his love because he sent the flood. But his love created a plan. And by the way, the word, the name Noah, I think we should take our break now. Yes. The name Noah means rest or hope, because Noah represents the hope that we'll have in heaven. So we're going to leave this with our break on a hopeful note. And we'll do the flood after the break.
Can you flip back to the prior slides?
Yeah. This slide or the one before?
Just that one.
Can I have time for a question?
Sure.
Just real quick. So, the father of Noah was
Lamech? Lamech, yeah.
But the father of... In chapter 4, this is a different Lamech.
Yeah, there are two... Yeah, right. The names are repeated.
Okay.
In this room, I'm sure there's at least two people that have the same name.
Yeah, and the father of Lamech was Methushael.
Yes.
But then the father of this one was Methuselah.
Right. There's more than one.
So there's like, they were like that close, the name.
Yeah, there's Elijah and Elisha. There's, yeah.
So that's, yeah, okay. That's two.
That's what the commentators say. There's just, you know, different people with the same name.
The number 77 and 700. I mean, is that a physical, actual number, or is it
What's that?
Symbol of some 77? Like, when you said Jesus said 77 times, or then...
Well, I'm pretty sure Jesus is saying, look, it's not like at the 78 you stop forgiving him, right?
Yeah.
So he's using the number symbolically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seven means perfect or complete,
oh, okay.
Right? Yeah.
And then that's,
yeah. So when he says 77 times, it's not just seven times, 77 times. Which refers back to Cain, who there was a judgment sevenfold, and Lamech, who pronounced judgment 77-fold, and he's turning that around and saying not judgment 7 and 77-fold, yeah, but grace, essentially, 7 and 77-fold. Yeah. But that 77 is clearly intended to be symbolic, because it's kind of hard to really... First of all, you're going to really keep count? If you start keeping count, that's a bad sign. Yeah.
Also, you said that Enoch and Elijah was taken up, and God was really, wanted Adam to have that kind of
character. That's my speculation. It's just, like I said.
I mean, God could have, he could control the DNA in somebody's body, right? I mean, he could have made Adam into have the same thing as Enoch. Why would he... Because I think he's expecting Adam to fall, I guess.
He knows that Adam will fall.
Well, yeah.
That's true.
So.
Yeah. But anyway, we are predestined for salvation, but we don't always accept that salvation. And God allows us a free will to not...
Yeah.
I mean, because knowing and predetermining are not the same thing.
Yes, yeah.
God knows what's going to happen, but he doesn't...
He doesn't control our DNA or the type of who we're going to be. Almost like randomly.
Well, DNA is out. That's just a physical thing. That's just that random kind of combination between I don't think God picks who marries who.
Yeah.
And then who marries who or who has sex with who determines what DNA.
Yeah.
I mean, God could step in and alter our DNA if he wanted to.
Yeah.
But the evidence is that he doesn't usually. Because you can do DNA tests.
Chance that it was all by random chance.
What was by random chance?
The people, you know, the character that you have, the character I have, is all by...
Our physical nature is due to the DNA, right?
Yeah. But
yeah, and that's ruled by natural laws, if I understand it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we have a spiritual nature, which is not subject to our DNA. I think it's affected by our DNA, though, because our DNA determines some of our tendencies. Some people, because of their DNA, have a little bit more temptation in this area than in that area.
Okay.
Yeah. Good questions.
Yeah.
Okay. If we're lucky, we'll get through Genesis 11. That'd be great. Hey, Pedro.
I read somewhere that led me to believe that the angels were asexual, sexless.
Well,
but I thought it said it, but it doesn't say it literally.
I don't think so.
Spiritual beings, right? Aren't they?
Well, hopefully we are as well.
Well, I mean, spiritual, like you can. Well, I guess you can touch them because like, there's many cases.
Who knows? There's so many things we don't know.
But I remember studying that passage. It was three theories, and I discarded the one having sex like, right away. But then
it is the most common interpretation.
Yeah.
For what it's worth. So.
How you doing?
Oh, doing fine. It's kind of weird. I'm only teaching two classes instead of my usual four or five classes. I taught that class at the prison. That's done, so it's like I'm not even.
You usually teach four. You're teaching two.
I usually teach four or five.
Well, that's nice, though.
Like yeah.
You have to have a break and kind of.
Well, I'm basically winding down. My normal amount of load has been 1.3 to 1.5. And I'm doing 0.9, and 0.2 of that I already did, so I'm doing 0.7. That's half. So I have time to study for this class. You know? Nice. Once this class finishes, I'm hoping to go back to doing some writing. I'm going to have me another muffin. These are good. Great muffins, Jan.
Oh, they are. I tell your wife I come to class for the muffins, and she laughs.
What's that?
I tell Jan I come to class for the muffins.
Yeah.
She thinks I'm kidding. So now, the sons of God, you think they were angels, or you talk about the Nephilim being angels?
The context of the same thing.
Oh, the Nephilim are the sons of God?
Yeah.
And they were,
or maybe they're descendants or something.
Pretty powerful people, though. I mean, physically.
Seems like it. The heroes of old.
Aren't they sometimes considered giants, the Nephilim?
Yes. In fact, Philo wrote a book, a treatise, called De Gigantum, about the giants.
Gotta have one more muffin.
So apparently the sons of God were a little bit more than mortal. Apparently the sons of God were a little bit more than mortal.
Not in my opinion.
Oh. I thought you said you thought they were angels too. Or not.
I said that's one theory, but I don't agree with it.
Oh, you don't agree with it. Oh, so excuse me. So they were.
I don't know.
You said you thought they were mortal.
Right, but I'm not saying they were.
I'm doing a proof.
But if you said, so you think they were mortal, then I'd say yes. Uh-oh. I forgot to stop the tape. So everybody's.
I didn't give permission to record me.
You didn't have it on.
You forgot to stop it.
Oh.